listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for today. I'd like to welcome everyone to the table. And we're just going to get right into it, Eric. We got a special guest on the line, and he's been on the program before. He's a friend of the program. His name's David Sein. He's the regional administrator with the United States Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, representing Arizona, California, Hawaii, and Nevada. So, David, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
It's great to have you back, David. Well, listen, there's some pretty exciting news here. The healthcare exchanges are about to finally set in for implementation. I think this is the last phase, if you will, of the Affordable Care Act. And tell us about this. This is only, what, less than a week away before the actual exchanges open up to the public at large?
Well, that's right. Next week on the 1st, people will have a new option to buy affordable health insurance with help for many of the people to defray the cost of that insurance, and we are exactly 100 days from the beginning of coverage on January 1st for those people to take advantage of the opportunity and avail themselves of the security that comes from having health insurance.
Well, that's excellent news, David. Obviously, it's been a long time coming. I'm sure many Americans are anxious to get this thing started. So let's start off with just the basics, though, David. Tell our listening audience exactly what is a health insurance marketplace.
Well, thank you, and thanks for using that expression, because that's the one that we like to use. The image I have in mind is when I go to my local market where I buy vegetables, I know all the vendors there, the farmers. I know the person that has the honey and the other things, and I can look at the products, and they're selling the same products, and just the prices are different or some other, the color's different or whatever. So this is a place where online, on the telephone, with a paper form, sitting down with one of the thousands of assisters that we're training around the country, people can determine, based upon their income and their family size and so forth, how much it will cost them to get insurance that, in many cases, will be subsidized for a discount to provide coverage for they and their families. And the important thing is all these plans cover the 10 essential benefits and have full coverage that people need.
Now, this enrollment, the open enrollment, if you will, it starts October 1st, but like you said, the actual implementation, the coverage in and of itself, won't start till January 1st, 2014. Where do the interested parties access this online?
It's easy. It's healthcare.gov, www.healthcare.gov, and that'll take you to the
Hi, David?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sounds like we just lost you temporarily there, but how? Continue.
What you're doing is choose from local insurance, providing coverage your locality.
Okay. Now, David, what are some of the – you talked about the 10 essential health care benefits. What are some of those benefits that are included in the Affordable Care Act here?
All of these plans offer hospitalization, doctor care, laboratory, home health, prescription drugs, pediatric, oral, and vision care. So all the things that we think of when we think of health insurance, unlike what's available today, where there's any range of policies, and you could easily buy a policy, be a 22-year-old woman, and find out that it didn't cover maternity. All these products do cover that as well.
Okay, so all of these services, like you said, emergency services, hospitalization, maternity and newborn care, prescription drugs, preventive care services, which would include things like disease screenings, vaccinations, chronic disease management, diabetes, pediatric services. Obviously, these are the core set of benefits that every health insurance company that wants to participate in this health insurance marketplace, they have to provide those coverage. Now
right.
That coverage. But now, David, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily all going to be coming at the same cost. So tell the listening audience how that can change, so how they can compare. They'll get these coverages, but will there be out-of-pocket expenses? Will there be copays? Will there be deductibles? How does that work?
So the individual issuers or insurance companies get to structure their product, you know, in a way that they think is going to be desirable in the marketplace, and they can offer additional benefits other than the basic. So they've all bid for the opportunity to sell insurance on the state marketplaces. And there will be a range of prices because of there are additional coverage possibly, and in some cases you have to think about, is the doctor, is the hospital that I want to work with this company, and you'll be able to check that out. The same might be true if you need a particular prescription drug that you take all the time. You want to make sure that they provide a favorable coverage for that, and this exchange mechanism via the computer, via the telephone, will allow you to research those questions. Also, the states are divided into smaller units. For example, Arizona is divided into 7 units because not every issuer is going to be able to cover the whole state. And there will be, in many states, multi-state plans for people to travel a lot or maybe have kids living away from school.
Okay, so let me get back to that issue of the prescription drug coverage, because I know that is always a big issue with respect to me as a physician taking care of my patients. There's often multiple formularies, and what a formulary is just that's a specific list of drugs that an insurance company would or would not cover, and if there's a copay involved, would these formularies be available so that people on the exchange could look at insurance plan A, B, and C and say, listen, I have actually diabetes and I have hypertension and I take these particular medications. Will there be a way for them to sort of just check off those medications and then basically see which insurance companies offer the most favorable pricing plan for them, or how would something like that work?
The best way to do this or to explain it is the initial questions when you encounter the marketplace sign up looks at income and where you live to determine what your subsidy level is. And I would also add, for people that are under 300% of poverty, that's like maybe $60,000 for a family, they also have reductions in their out-of-pocket expenses. But setting that aside for a moment, when you go through that, you'll see the plans that are available to you and what the cost is going to be to you. Then you can go in and individually explore those plans via a link to that provider's website and find out what drugs they cover at what prices, because we know about the tiers and there's some complexity. So it's not dissimilar to the way we do it in Medicare, but we're not hosting quite the same type of site because there's so many different vendors in all the different states. So you have to go to the vendor and look at it.
Okay, now also from my understanding, there's a calculator online, an online calculator that's been developed by the Kaiser Family Foundation that could help assist you with respect to cost savings, et cetera. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I know they put up a product at kff.org. That's a nonprofit organization that does helpful things around healthcare, and folks can go to that, put in their family income and where they live, and get an idea of how much subsidy they may be entitled to. But come October 1st, healthcare.gov is really the place where you want to go and do that. Rather than getting a prediction, you'll get the actual discounts, as we call them. And I want to point out again, of the 30-plus million people in the country that don't have insurance that we can help, probably half of them are going to be entitled to some sort of discount or subsidy to make it affordable.
Okay, and those subsidies are generally on a tiered basis, correct? So depending on what your financial status is and where you are with respect to the poverty level, you'll probably get more subsidies if you're below the poverty level versus obviously at or above, correct?
Well, to put it in a simple terms, for people, let's just take a family. For a family less than $23,000 a year, they're going to qualify for their state Medicaid program, which has no premium.
Right.
In almost all the states, there's a couple states that aren't doing that. Then, from that $23,000 all the way up to $94,000 for a family of four, there's a subsidy. It's sliding with how much your income is, and generally you're going to end up with a premium that's about 9% of your income.
Of your income. All right. Well, listen, David, if you have some time, do you mind holding on? Because I'm sure we have a lot more questions and maybe some calls too.
Great.
Okay, we're here with David Sein. He's the regional administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And we're going to be back talking about the implementation. It starts the enrollment October 1st, 2013 for the health insurance marketplace. So stay tuned.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting here with David Sein. He is a regional administrator with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act and the open enrollment that's going to be starting here just shortly, within about roughly a week, October 1st, 2013, in which case you can enroll in these health insurance marketplaces, pick a product that is suitable to your needs, customize it to yourself as an individual or to your family, and then that particular insurance product will take effect come January of 2014. So, David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Good. Well, David, before I get to some of the callers, and if people want to call in, we'll keep the phone lines open right now. David can take some calls at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. David, tell us about kids, though. A lot of parents, a lot of family members are concerned about children. How could my child be covered under this? If I have, you know, two kids, if I have five kids, if I have 10 kids, how does that work with respect to children in this health insurance marketplace?
Sure. Well, for openers, remember under the Affordable Care Act, we've got several million young adults now that are staying on their parents' employer-based insurance until they're into well into their 20s now. But nonetheless, we know there's a lot of 20-somethings. One of our campaigns is targeting moms to get on the kids' Facebook and bug them to get health insurance. So there's lots of angles to this. But the important thing is, if you've got dependent kids at home, this subsidy business is based on the size of your family. Up until you get about three kids, then the price doesn't go up anymore. So you can buy coverage for your family, or you may be in a situation where you have employer-based insurance, but you can't put your spouse or your son on the policy. You can put them on it. About the only people that aren't candidates for this are people that don't have legal residence in the U.S. or people that are on Medicare, because people that are on Medicare already have health insurance, so they don't need to really worry about this. Our target is those 30-some million people that have no insurance at all.
Okay, excellent. Hey, I'm going to take a few calls if you don't mind, David. Is that
sure.
Okay? All right, I'm going to go first to Susan, who's actually having a question. She's listening and watching, actually, on Free Speech TV. So, Susan, welcome to the table.
Hi, Dr. Mike. My question is, for people like me who do not have a computer, I don't have access to a computer, I don't even know how to use a computer, but I definitely want to enroll in the program. Is there an 800 number? Because I see, like, website numbers popping up. But for people such as myself, is there an 800 number that you can possibly give me who can walk me through this and where I can sign up through the 800 number? And my second question is, I do pay for my own insurance. I work for a mom-and-pop business where they don't provide it. And I currently have my own coverage through Blue Cross Blue Shield. Would I be able to get on the program through Blue Cross Blue Shield? I'm kind of ignorant as far as that goes.
Okay, Susan, thank you for the question. David?
I didn't fully understand the Blue Cross Blue Shield comment. We do have a 1-800 number. No one needs to have a computer to take advantage of this program, and I'm going to read that number off at the end so people have a pencil ready. And we are also going to have assisters, people in the community, people at hospitals, people at senior centers, who will be able to meet with people one-on-one if you want to sit down and talk about it. So there'll be plenty of avenues to join. And I didn't understand your Blue Shield comment, though. I don't have it respond to that.
All right. Well, anyway, Dave, we got other callers too, so I'm going to get to that before. But I do have a few other questions I wanted to ask you as well. One of the issues that I've seen out there as well is the network size. Now, are there any particular requirements under the Affordable Care Act with respect? Did you want to ask that question?
Yes. I didn't realize that I was on the air. Yes, I will wait for that 800 number. I do appreciate it. And unfortunately, I live in Georgia, and I don't see anything advertised on the TV at all. So I feel like they're kind of keeping us in the dark. And the question that I guess my real important question was, I wanted that 800 number. But my second question, if I may, my Blue Cross Blue Shield did send me a letter saying that they were going to offer something, and is that part of the program?
Okay, let's see what David has to say there.
Okay, I don't know what their offering is where you live. So I'm sure there will be many Blue Cross Blue Shield plans on the exchange. but we haven't announced them yet. We're going to do that next week. But now, there will still be insurance outside of these exchanges. Nobody has to use this marketplace approach to buy insurance unless you want to take advantage of the subsidy that I spoke about. That's the really important thing. The number is 1-800-318-2596. That's 318-2596. And so what I really want to stress is, while we open for business on October 1st, this open enrollment period lasts all the way until March of 2014. So you got 180 days, plenty of time to look at this thing and make sure that the plan you're going to buy covers the drugs you need, works with the doctor you want. Now, Doctor, you asked this question about the networks. Who are
right.
doctors, the hospitals that I can use with the insurance I buy? That's something that the consumer needs to look at when they buy the product. If you buy one of those electric cars that only goes 100 miles, it's no good if you work 120 miles away from your home. Same thing here. So if you can't figure it out from the website and you're thinking about Company A, call Company A and have them explain to you who's the hospital in your neighborhood. Do they cover this medicine? These companies want to help you. They want customers, and I'm sure they'll be more than happy to help people figure out the details of their particular coverage.
No question about it. Dave, we got Carol on the line calling in from AM 760 in Englewood, Colorado. Carol, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, hi.
Hello.
I would just like them to address the mental health benefits. Are they mandatory in all the plans or optional?
Okay. Yeah, under a statute passed a few years ago, we're now requiring what's called parity, or that services for behavioral or mental health conditions are covered in the same way, at the same value as other kinds of health concerns. So, yes, these plans offer behavioral health services on a footing with their regular physical health services, if you will.
Excellent. All right, well, David, listen, we appreciate your time on the air today. I know we still got some callers, but I can handle those. If they want to check out more information, just give us the website one last time.
Healthcare.gov, 800-318-2596.
All right, thank you so much, David. Okay, we'll be back with your calls at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for today, and want to thank everybody for calling in. We're going to get to your calls in a second. But, Eric, we need to discuss this because, look, this is a great program. You have this health insurance marketplace that is set to go into open enrollment starting in literally about a week.
Sounds like a win-win situation all the way around.
It's a win-win for everybody. But yet, here we have the prospect, Eric, that come October 1st, the Republicans in the House – and in the Senate. Look, and I don't want to make this a partisan thing. As a physician, I think healthcare should be something that is common to us as brothers and sisters. It shouldn't be a political football, healthcare. When it comes to healthcare, we should respect human beings, we should look after our brothers and sisters, and we should do whatever we can within our power to make sure that every citizen in this country, if you really want to call yourself a patriot, if you really want to say, you know what, I love my country, I love America. Well, you can't love your country, you can't love America, if you don't love your fellow Americans, okay?
Citizens.
What's that?
Fellow citizens.
Or your fellow citizens. That's the bottom line. So when you look at what's happened with the Affordable Care Act, they call it Obamacare, and they try to do that in a very belittling type of way. But it's,
right.
You know, only a conservative in America could take somebody's last name and affix the word care to it and try to make it sound like it's a dirty word, Eric. Like, oh, my God, it's Obamacare.
Instead of what it's really called.
Right, right, the Affordable Care Act. But in any case, we've been down this road, okay? The House passed this into law, okay? The Senate, the United States Senate, passed this into law in 2010. The President of the United States signed it into law. The Supreme Court of the United States of America, which right now, for all intents and purposes, is a right-leaning, conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Even that Supreme Court, Eric, Chief Justice Roberts,
held it up.
They said it is constitutional. The actual Affordable Care Act is constitutional.
How many times have they tried to repeal it? 40
They've tried to repeal it over 40 times. I think it's up to 42 times that the House has tried to repeal Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act.
What a waste of taxpayer dollars.
Eric, we're talking literally millions and millions of dollars that have been squandered just trying to repeal it.
When they could be doing something else.
Right. You could be doing a hell of a lot more with millions and millions of dollars than just trying to repeal it. And then, really, the coup de grace here is that if you really look at the last election cycle, when President Obama ran for his second term, he ran on that as part of his signature legislation, Eric. I mean, that was one of the big pieces of legislation that he said to the American public. Guess what? The days of insurance companies denying you care because you have a quote-unquote pre-existing condition, because, look, people were sick and tired of it, Eric. I mean, I'm sure you've run into this. I know family members, personal friends. You know, it's not six degrees of separation. It's like a half a degree of separation. People who have not been able to get affordable health care insurance because insurance companies said, guess what? If you're sick, I don't want to cover you. If you're healthy and you have no medical problems, I'd love to cover you for insurance because I know I'm going to make a hell of a lot of money off of you because you're no risk to me. And that for ages here in America has, quite frankly, been one of the most unethical, immoral things that we've turned a blind eye and a deaf ear to, until finally, you know, in essence, Democrats said enough is enough. Republican conservatives had fought this tooth and nail every step of the way because they feel that insurance companies have a right primarily to make more money at your expense, at your pain, at your suffering. And this is why one of the main features of this Affordable Care Act, which goes into effect January 2014, is that all of these insurance companies, Eric, in this health insurance marketplace, they cannot deny you now coverage based off of a pre-existing condition, and they can't charge you more as a consequence.
However,
of that,
they're going to be getting a lot more business.
Right, and they're going to be getting a lot more business. So why anyone would be against that is beyond me. But as I was saying, the president offered this up to the American people in the 2012 election cycle, Eric. He said, hey, this is the legislation that was passed by House Democrats, Senate Democrats, and signed into law by the Democratic president. This thing was fought tooth and nail by conservative Republicans every step of the way, and they continue to fight it, as you said, voting 42 times and squandering millions of our taxpayer dollars to try to defund it when they know it's not going to happen. The Senate's not going to do it. The president's not going to veto his own signature piece of legislation.
He'd veto their thing. Yeah.
Right. So that's the bottom line, is that it is the law of the land, and then the people even reject it. In 2012, in the general election, Mitt Romney, who said he wants to defund Obamacare and
– or we're shutting the government down.
Well, he didn't say shut the government down at that point, but that's what it's come to. But every step along the way, the American people have repeatedly said, we want this law. And now here we are, 1 week away, and this is like their final gasp, their last breath, their last ditch effort, Eric, to try to really do – an end run around it and just jettison the whole legislation, saying that if we don't raise our debt limit, just so people understand this, that if we don't raise our debt limit, okay, that means, guess what? We won't be able to pay our bills, in essence. And what the Republicans, who they say, conservatives, they're fiscally responsible, right, Eric? You're supposed to be fiscally responsible. Where in fiscal responsibility?
Yeah, the taxpayers are all supposed to be fiscally responsible.
Right, but where in fiscal responsibility does it say, hey, let's screw all our creditors out there and let's not pay them? Let's not, even though we said you have the full faith and credit of the United States government behind these deals, behind these agreements, we're now going to say, screw you. We're not going to pay you. This is what the Republicans are saying. They would rather see the economy collapse than people actually get health care to care for their sick mom with diabetes, to care for the father who's got Alzheimer's disease, to care for a child who's coughing and can't breathe and has got cystic fibrosis, to care for a mentally ill patient who's got depression and just is down and out and doesn't feel like they want to live anymore. That's what they're saying. In essence, this is what conservative legislators across America are saying pretty much in unison. When you look at the House vote and what happened with the House of Representatives, almost along straight party lines, House Republicans said, we want to see Americans continue to be sick. We want our fellow brothers and sisters to be ill. We do not want to help you. We don't care if you're coughing or you can't breathe or you can't walk or you can't see or you have, you know, crushing chest pain. We don't care. We would rather shut the government down and fight this ideological battle and see in the process not only you get sicker, but the economy gets sicker too.
I think it cost $1.4 billion to shut the government and reopen it last time they did that in the
90s. Just to do that.
Just to do that.
To take the little key to the government and open it and close it.
Because you lose money in passports, you lose money in national parks and services, you lose money everywhere.
But I would beg the question, honestly, Eric. So where is the compassionate conservative that we heard about back when George Bush ran for office? Remember we talked about compassionate conservatives. And I'm not saying this to pick a fight. I'm not saying it because I'm trying to be, you know, the liberal host here. I want to know what is a compassionate conservative? Because if what you're telling me right now, when practically every House Republican member says, I'd rather shut the government down, I'd rather see the economy go into a tailspin, I'd rather see people lose their jobs, I'd rather see people sick without access to the healthcare system, I honestly ask the question, if there's somebody out there who happens to be a compassionate conservative, is that your view of what a compassionate conservative does to his fellow citizens, to the fellow Americans, to our brothers and sisters? Is that how we operate now in this country? That, you know, we're more beholden to lobbyists and people who donate money to political campaigns than we are to our fellow citizens? I just don't get it. And as a physician, I can tell you for sure, for 100% sure, for somebody who's been in medicine 20 plus years, I can tell you 100% the Affordable Care Act is the best thing that has ever happened to this country with respect to our healthcare system. Is it the end all, Eric? Is it going to solve every problem? Absolutely not.
No, but it can be revised and finessed over time.
But it's a starting point. It's a foundation, okay? You have to start with a foundation, and it's the right foundation to say to people, guess what? You can go now into the marketplace and get insurance and not have to worry about being denied coverage because you happen to be sick. I mean, is that how we're going to judge people? If we're a Christian nation, we're supposed to be a Christian nation. Did Jesus say, hey, you know, Paul, Luke, take it easy with the leper there. You know, he's going to cost a lot more money, and I don't think I could work my magic, you know.
He's got a pre-existing condition.
Yeah, he's got a pre-existing condition. And, you know, that blind guy over there, you know, that's his problem. You know, he was born with diabetes. I know it was a genetic thing, and, yeah, I know that God actually gives you the genetics, you know. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe my father wasn't thinking that time when he gave the guy with diabetes, you know, bad genes. But, look, you know, we don't want to deal with him, though, now. Come on, you know how hard it is to cure blindness in a diabetic with retinopathy? Come on, Paul, you think that's easy? You think that's easy for me to do? I mean, this is kind of what their thinking is, okay? And I say this sort of dramatically and tongue-in-cheek, but think about it. In a Christian nation, is that how Jesus would operate? Would Jesus pick and choose, you know, who he chose to heal? Of course not. Would he pick and choose who he chose to feed? I mean, right now we have the House, talking about defunding food stamps. You know, food stamps at a time when the economy has not yet recovered. We've had one of the worst economic crises in decades. And they want to take food out of people's mouth. They want to take food out of the hungry's mouth. They want the sick to get sicker. They want the government to shut down. They want the economy to collapse. They want people to become unemployed. Is this what a compassionate conservative is all about? Back in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting from the desert here in Phoenix, Arizona, 1480 KPHX, Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for today, welcoming compassionate conservatives to the table right now at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. And look, this is not sort of bait and hook here. I really want to hear if you are conservative out there and you really agree with shutting down the government, denying people health care, taking away food stamps from the hungry, defunding science. I mean, I'd like to understand from your perspective how that makes America better. What is the conservative philosophy to move this country forward? That being said, 1-866-987-8466 is the number. Let me get to some of the calls here, Eric, because some people have been holding for quite some time here.
Any compassionate conservatives on the line?
I don't see them yet. You know, maybe that's sort of the problem. There are none out there. There are no real compassionate conservatives. Maybe somebody's like, you know what, I'm conservative.
Not even some pretenders?
But I'm not even – they're saying, you know what, I'm conservative, but I'm not really compassionate, so I can't really call in and, you know, help the doctor out with this one. So let's go next to Jerry. Jerry listening on 760 in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Jerry, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi there. Yes, no, I'm certainly not conservative, and they're all listening to the Rush Limbaugh. Yeah, my comment is I'm 68, mm-hmm. poor sham and old lady on Medicare, but I have noticed that even our Democratic state senators in the state, they are blue dog. Why? Mm-hmm. Because you see at the side of their name that they happen to work for a certain medical company or something. Hello? Are you there?
Yeah, no, I'm listening, Jerry. No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, basically what you're saying is there are even Democrats out there who, if they're somehow or another affiliated with the healthcare industry and their campaign coffers are being filled by people in the healthcare industry, they seem to be more beholden to their corporate sponsors and lobbyists than they are to their constituents, the people. And that's unfortunately sad, Jerry, because I can tell you for sure, Jerry, as a physician, I'm a geriatric physician. I take care of people like yourself, okay? People who are in Medicare, 65 years and older, also the disabled, and people with chronic illnesses. That's my life. That's what I do. Okay, I can tell you for sure the people with whom I work right now, Jerry, on a day-to-day basis, and people who realize that the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land right now, they are all working together across the table, Republicans, Democrats alike. Today, I went to a meeting today, okay, and it was a meeting whereby it was sponsored by a hospital. The hospital case management team put this together. There were doctors there. There were nursing home administrators there. There were social workers there. There were people representing hospice there. Everybody was sitting around the table because of the Affordable Care Act saying, how can we deliver care better because of this health care law? Years ago, Jerry, that never happened. Years ago, all the different parts of the healthcare system were like ships passing in the night. The hospital would do their own thing. The doctors would do their own thing. The nursing home would do their own thing. The hospice would do their own thing. Nobody ever worked together, Jerry. And as a consequence, because no one really worked together to coordinate care, to provide the best treatment algorithms, the best treatment protocols, to find the best cost but the best outcomes, no one ever did that. And as a consequence, that's where our healthcare system became very inefficient. But today, to sit at this meeting, Jerry, was at 7:00 in the morning here in Arizona on a Monday. Okay, everybody coming back from a relaxing weekend, people had to drive 40, 50 miles to get to this meeting, which meant that most people had to get up at 5:00 in the morning. And I was touched, Jerry. I was so touched to see people having that dedication, that inspiration to get to that meeting and say, guess what? We're going to put partisan politics aside. We're not going to talk about Democrats. We're not going to talk about Republicans. We're not going to talk about, liberals or conservatives. Guess what we're going to talk about? People, patients, and what can we do to make it right by the patients. So what I'm just telling you, Jerry, is that there were no politicians at that table. There was no state legislators. There were no congressmen or women because these were people who deliver care, who we put our hands on the patients and want to make the world a better place. And it was very inspiring for me to see that.
There are, meanwhile, hundreds of other meetings in hundreds of other cities in America, and they are so upset that, first of all, there's two serious factions that are fighting this. Thank you, John Boehner, and all the GOP in the House. Number one is half of them are so upset that it will include all citizens, including certain people born south of the border. And the others are the extreme right wing, like my cousin in Virginia, who thinks mm-hmm. all women should have one baby per year until she can't have them anymore.
Right. But then they don't want to cover the children. Listen, I appreciate your call, Jerry. I'm going to get the other people. Thank you so much for calling in. Let me just try to get a few other quick calls in here. Let's go to Corky on the line, listening on Free Speech TV. Corky, welcome to the table.
Hello, doctor. Yeah, I think you're onto something here. What you have to look at is there's two divisions. You have the Republican GOP, who is a more corporate-leaning entity, and you got the progressives who, like you just said, are concerned with people in a better life.
Right.
And to the Republican, the GOP, everything is dollar-cost average. If I put a $20,000 hip in you, am I going to get it back? Are you going to be able to produce for me in the future?
So right, and it goes back to fundamentally what I was saying about us being a Christian nation, Corky. Jesus never attached strings to his miracles, did he? He never said to the guy he rose from the dead, look, you know, I'll raise you from the dead, but guess what? For the next 10 years, you're going to have to pay Luke and, you know, Paul a stipend of 100, you know, drachmas each month until, you know, we ante up with you.
Isn't death a pre-existing condition?
Yeah, I guess that would be a pre-existing condition.
It's okay if you call this a Christian-leaning nation, because I don't see anything leaning towards Christianity.
No.
Everything is the dollar is the God.
Right, I agree. And where do they put in God we trust? On our currency of all things, you know? It doesn't put it on, you know, the stethoscope, or doesn't put it on, you know, the hospital respirator. It's on the almighty dollar, like you said. And that's, you know, unfortunate. It's very unfortunate, Corky. But listen, there's lots of people out there, including yourself, including the listeners, the fans of Tom Hartman, who truly believe in helping our fellow brothers and sisters, regardless of if they're Democrat, Republican, liberal. You know, we don't judge. That's the difference, is we don't judge. But you look at the House Republicans and you look at what they're trying to do by holding this country hostage and looking for our economy to tank and to take away people's health care, to take away their food stamps, to take away science, to get rid of teachers. That's a pretty horrible, horrible vision for America's future. And I don't think we, the people, are going to stand for it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting here in the seat today. I'd like to welcome everyone to the table. Look, gun violence, it continues on unabated. I mean, we just saw over this past weekend, even in other countries, in Nairobi, Kenya, mall shootings. We also saw the Washington, D.C., the Navy Yard shootings. It just goes on and on and on. So today, we are very fortunate to have with us Elliot Feinman. Elliot is the founder and president of the National Gun Victims Action Council, but also has a very personal story to tell us with respect to gun violence in this country. So, Elliot, welcome to the table.
Mike, thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes. Well, Elliot, before we get started about the actual organization that you founded, tell us a little bit about your personal story, because you have an actual child that a story needs to be told here.
Well, tragically, that's the case. That's the case. On the morning of December 31st, 2006, a Chicago policewoman came to my door to tell me that my son had been murdered the night before, sitting in a restaurant having dinner with his wife in San Diego, where he lived. The murderer would turn out to be a paranoid schizophrenic, and the murderer would also turn out to have gotten their gun legally through one of the holes in our gun laws, which says that if you are involuntarily committed to a mental health institution, you lose your gun rights. But if you voluntarily commit yourself, then you don't. So the murderer had twice voluntarily committed himself to a mental institution, but that had no effect on his ability to get a gun. So he legally got the gun. And what happened was my son, who was a combat medic with Special Forces, he was also an award-winning designer. He had kind of those twin personalities. He was both a soldier and an artist. And the killer was hovering over his table. He walked into a restaurant that they really, you know, was a kind of place a person in that dress like that wouldn't really belong. But at any rate, they started hovering over my son's table. When all was said and done, my son asked the restaurant waiter to call 911. Instead, they walked the murderer outside, and he came back 11 minutes later and put four bullets into my son's head.
Wow. So sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was and is, you know, just horrible, just horrible.
Now, Elliot, tell the listeners, though, I mean, to go through that incredible tragedy, and I can't even fathom something like that happening, but you took what was a tragedy and now are trying to heighten the awareness, you know, locally, nationally, worldwide, about things that we could do to implement sane gun laws. You're by no means, all the research that I've done on your council, are you saying that no one should have a gun, but you really are talking about sane gun laws. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, the issue, when I was able to function, by the way, Mike, and it took quite some time,
sure,
but I closed my practice. I was a strategic marketing advisor to Fortune 500 companies. And I decided I would spend the rest of my life bringing that skill set to the gun issue. And so I looked at the gun issue from a strategic point of view, the way I would have looked at any strategy problem, you know, for a Fortune 500 company. And what became clear was that the strategy our side was following, which we follow still, which is asking legislators to do the right thing by presenting evidence, by making appeals to conscience, moral arguments, by talking to them, sending them emails, protesting, etc., could not be successful. And without one ingredient that was missing, which is what, and it's an ingredient that's been part of every major social change. It's an economic lever. If you think about Gandhi's salt strike, our labor laws here, civil rights, gay and lesbian rights, they've always had an economic component to them. And our side didn't have that. So at the federal level, we'd gone 0 for 19 years. We're still 0 for 19 years for passing a single law. And since the Brady Act was passed, it's now 19 years. There's not been one single law passed at the federal level that would have served to reduce gun violence. In fact, just the opposite. Many laws have been passed, such as the Tiahrt Amendment, such as guns in national parks, such as guns on Amtrak trains, etc. Many laws have been passed that would increase gun violence. So what we've done is we've started... And anybody can join it. If I can just say, if they can go to our website, www.gunvictimsaction.org, we've added an economic mix strategy. It's called Tell and Compel. We say we're done asking. You know, we've asked for 19 years. We're done.
Sure.
You know, now we're going to tell you what to do, and if you don't do it, we're going to deliver economic pain. Not to you, the legislator. You know, we're not going to play that game. We're going to deliver it to your state. We're going to deliver it to corporations headquartered in your state. But we're going to deliver severe economic pain until you vote for sane gun laws. And if you were to ask me, as you did, what are some sane gun laws? Well, obviously, closing the gun show loopholes are critical. If I'm sure the listeners are aware, but for anyone who's not, the Brady campaign established a requirement that anybody going to a federally firearms licensed gun dealer had to go through a background check. So their name was matched with an FBI database that was supposed to say this person could or could not buy a gun. But if your name is on that database and you're rejected, you can simply go to any gun show or go online or do a private sale and get any weaponry you want. Astonishingly,
wow.
If you'd want to talk about insanity, we have a no-fly list, and suspected terrorists cannot buy a plane ticket. They can't get on a plane.
Right.
But they can go to any gun store and legally buy any weaponry they want, including weaponry that could bring down a plane landing or taking off.
That's so insane.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane.
No question. Elliot, tell the listeners about this economic lever that you spoke of earlier, in the sense that there was some success this week in the national news media with respect to Starbucks. And do you have time to come back? Because we're going to be coming up on a break. I'd like you to finish your thoughts. So do you have time for a few more minutes?
I have all the time you have, Mike. So.
All right. Beautiful, because this is an important issue. So, but we could start off the discussion about Starbucks. Tell us what happened there.
Well, Starbucks, we started a boycott of Starbucks on Valentine's Day of 2012. We worked with our partners, the Episcopal Peace Fellowship and the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And the essence of the boycott was to get Starbucks to do what they do in their own corporate headquarters, which is to ban guns.
All right, now hold it right there, because that's a great segue, Elliot. We're going to be back with Elliot Fineman. He is the founder of National Gun Victims Action Council, and we're going to be back talking about a force for seeing gun laws.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb here with Elliot Fineman. He is the founder and president of the National Gun Victims Action Council. You can learn more about that at www.gunvictimsaction.org. And he was spurred to action tragically by the death of his son at the hands of a paranoid schizophrenic. And unfortunately, you know, it took that to happen. But, Elliot, we thank you for your service and your advocacy with respect to this issue.
Well, I appreciate that, Mike. Yeah, it did take that to happen, and nothing I can do will ever bring my son back, but everything I can do to help families and others not have to go through this is what will spend the rest of my life doing till we accomplish that.
No, and we appreciate that. So let's get back to what we were talking about earlier with respect to the way that gun lobbying and activism has been approached in the past. In the past, as you said, it was more of a legislative-centric approach, but what you're advocating is more of an eco-centric, economic-centric, using the lever of and the power of money to change people's thinking and to heighten the awareness. So we were talking about Starbucks, and that the CEO recently, this past week, came out with a statement with respect to open carry in the Starbucks facility. So perhaps you can elaborate on your role in that and your organization's role, Elliot, and what the outcome was.
Oh, sure, I'd be happy to. We initiated a boycott on Valentine's Day in 2012 after having exhausted every possibility of getting Starbucks to ban all guns from their stores, not only open carry, but conceal and carry. Starbucks refused to. I had spoken to the board, Senator Bill Bradley, who was on the board at that time, and they simply wouldn't change their policy. So we called for a boycott. On the very day we called for it, the pro-gunners started their first of their gun appreciation days, showing up in Starbucks at all around the country, either open carrying or conceal and carrying and taking their guns out, showing them drinking coffees and, you know, with their guns.
Mm-hmm.
This was not, and posting those pictures on the Starbucks Facebook page, this was not something Starbucks was too excited about. They ultimately took the pictures down. But the upshot is that the pro-gunners began to use Starbucks as a rallying point for gun appreciation days whenever something happened that threatened, in their mind, their gun ownership. They even had the, and I wrote a piece about it, you know, calling them psychopaths, to have a gun appreciation day 2 weeks after Newtown.
Right.
In the country, they held. I mean, you don't, there are no words for it, you know. But anyway, they did that. So Starbucks refused to change their policy. They said that they're following local laws. But that was intellectually dishonest because local laws, in fact, allowed them to ban guns from their stores.
Correct.
Just as places like Disney and Pete's Coffee and California Pizza Kitchen and IKEA have done. So they could have, what they were really doing is they were choosing between two local laws, one to allow them guns and one to ban them, and they chose to allow them. So the boycott started, and one of the things we pointed out was how morally, I don't know what the right word is, but what lacking of integrity this was, because Starbucks...
Reprehensible.
Reprehensible. Good word. What Starbucks does is they ban guns in their corporate headquarters. Why? By the way, every major corporation in the country, including the NRA, I might add, bans guns in their corporate headquarters.
Hmm.
Why? Because they're dangerous.
Sure.
One knows an environment with guns is less safe than an environment without guns. So they then pass this risk on to their customers by allowing guns in their stores, but didn't even have the good taste to or integrity to put up a sign saying guns are welcome here. So there's a risk they wouldn't take that they passed on to their customers and wouldn't tell their customers about it.
Right.
Which it reprehensible is maybe double reprehensible.
Sure.
But it's
cowardly, too.
Cowardly. Absolutely cowardly. So after Newtown happened, I went up to Newtown and just interacted with many of the people there who have become friends now. And they decided when they heard about the Starbucks situation, they have three Starbucks in that area. They decided to get involved with the boycott. They formed a coalition for corporate responsibility. They got Moms Demand Action to work very closely with them. We were working closely with them. And they published a public letter that was in the Wall Street Journal in late August saying, you know, we would like Starbucks to change their policy, and we really want to meet with Howard Schultz to discuss it. So they had the moral weight. You know, it was the Newtown Coalition.
Sure.
That had the moral authority and the moral weight to get Schultz to, instead of meeting with them, he communicated, he had one of his key representatives communicate with them. But the bottom line was that he issued this statement saying that guns were not welcome. They're not banning them, but they're not welcome.
Right. And that made a big difference, because obviously when you look at the bottom line numbers, it cost millions and millions of dollars in lost revenue and sales because of this moral courageousness, if you will, that was conducted on behalf of the organizations that you had pulled together into a coalition. Listen, it's again, thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, Elliot, for coming and sharing your story today. It's not easy to do that. And thank you for your continued activism with respect to this very, very important issue in our society. And if you want to give the website one last time, please give it to them.
I will do it. Yes, go to www.gunvictimsaction.org.
Okay.
Sign the Tell and Compel pledge.
Thank you.
Right,
thank you so much.
Page.
Okay, Elliot, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike sitting in for today. A special thanks there to Elliot Feynman. Eric, that's got to be something to come on the national stage like that and talk about your son who was, like, literally gunned down in cold blood, point-blank range.
Something you could never possibly get over.
No, it's something you never imagine or never get over. But to take that tragedy, that personal tragedy, and turn that into activism that's ultimately going to save people's lives, hopefully translate into more sane gun laws, is very admirable on behalf of Elliot Feynman's behavior. So, but listen, the Freedom Lines are open. I'm going to get to some of the Freedom Lines here in one quick second. It's 1-866-987-THOM if you want to participate in today's dialogue. We've spoken about a lot of different things today. We opened up the program with David Sein and talked about the new healthcare insurance marketplaces that are debuting with the open enrollment starting October 1st, going all the way to March 1st of 2014. You'll be able to actually have that healthcare benefit take effect in January of 2014. So we talked about the defunding of Obamacare, if you will, how Republican legislators in the House and in the Senate are looking to undermine the president's signature legislation and to hold this country economically hostage by not allowing the debt limit to go up and allowing America to default on its economic obligations, which would ultimately send this country into an economic tailspin and perhaps a recession, maybe even a depression. God only knows if we start defaulting on paying our bills. That could be devastating, absolutely devastating to our economy. So we talked about those issues. You're more than happy to take some phone calls regarding that. We talked about the gun violence here. I just was thinking about this too, Eric, during the break. We had here in Tucson, right, Tucson, Arizona, when Congresswoman Giffords was shot point blank in the head by Jared Loughner, and that was outside a grocery store.
It was a strip mall, yeah.
Yeah, strip mall. Then you had Aurora, Colorado. That was in a movie theater.
Right.
Then we had the Newtown in Connecticut, and that was in an elementary school. Then recently we had the Washington Navy Yard, so that's in a military establishment.
I mean, and that's just recently.
Yeah. And we also had recently, not here, but in Nairobi, Kenya, in a mall. I mean, so it's happening everywhere, Eric. It's not like it's just happening like somebody was at a bar and was drunk and got, you know, into a fight with somebody and there's some gun violence. I mean, you know, it's happening everywhere. And then obviously with Elliot Feynman and his son, that was at a restaurant. So you had a mall, a restaurant, a school, a grocery store, a movie theater, a military establishment. I mean, come on. I mean, I know that the NRA – who's the head of that NRA?
Wayne LaPierre.
Yeah, Wayne LaPierre. So I remember Wayne LaPierre was talking about, you know, the only way, you know, to solve the problem is, you know, to put more guns into the hands of good people.
Right. Armed society is a polite society.
Right, exactly. But so what's he saying? So everywhere you go now, based off of what we just talked about, grocery stores and movie theaters and elementary schools.
Here in Arizona, it's the wild, wild west.
You have to go everywhere with a gun? I mean, just it's insane. Who wants to live in a world like that? And to think that that is the solution. I mean, it just is absolutely, absolutely not the way for society to be going.
Well, you know, and like this gentleman we just had on said, usually it's somebody mentally ill who was not screened properly or just was legally still able to get a gun regardless of what his...
Right, because he voluntarily went into treatment.
Yeah, shouldn't it be, even if you volunteer, you should have to give up your gun rights? Because something's wrong there.
Well, that's a very touchy issue. I can see why, because if you're paranoid schizophrenic, you know, you can have times when if you're not properly, you know, medicated or you're not seeing your doctor, then you have this divorce from reality.
Right, but there's the times with the divorce from reality. And if you know that could come, then there's no reason that person should have a gun.
And it gets to a point where I could see gun right advocates saying, well, look, they have just as much right as anyone else just because they're ill.
Only 50% of the time.
Yeah, no. So it's a tough issue. But the point is there should be more rules and regulations to address such issues. I mean, we saw with Jared Loughner in Tucson where he was going to the community college out there, the Pima Community College.
They told him not to come back until he had a note from
the doctor. They just said he was acting very erratically, very aberrantly, and that he really needed a letter, certified letter from an actual healthcare professional that he was able
mental
health care professional that he was able to come back into the school setting and that he was well. And so here you have clearly systems being activated in the sense that we were aware of his problems, but nothing was done. And here he was able to go out and get guns and ammunition and just walk down to a strip mall and start putting bullets in people's heads. I mean, that doesn't make sense in this society. And I guess how many more tragedies are we going to need to have before such time that there are sane conversations and sane gun laws put on the books? I thought we had our best opportunity after the Newtown killings and all those children.
But you know. I predict there'll be many, many more instances before something's done.
Yeah, it's just very, very sad. So in any case, let me get to some of the Freedom Lines right now because I know people have been waiting right now. So let me pull up the actual screen here and let's just go to Frank first. Frank is listening in Cambridge, Massachusetts on FSTV, Free Speech TV. So Frank, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate your introduction with the healthcare, but what caught my ear was the talk later on about gun control. And I think from my own point of view, after dealing with this for a while, is that what we are dealing with is like the old Chinese puzzle, finger puzzle, where each person puts his finger in a puzzle in a little building and tries to pull out, and they can't do it. Mm-hmm. They can't pull back. It's like a Chinese, they used to call it a Chinese finger puzzle when I was a kid, 50, 60 years ago.
They still
have. That's what we've got now. And the more you attack these people, the more they're going to hanker down. I suggest this is not suggesting, you know, anything about everyone carries a gun, but from the age of 12 to 14, and this is based on my own experience, all this is based on my own experience, everybody goes out and registers for a course in handling a gun. Now, here's a story. I'm basing this on my own story. When I was 14 years old, I wanted to have a shotgun. And I bought a shotgun, and my father told me how to use it. Took me into a field, set up an old rusty barrel, and I shot it. And it nearly knocked my right shoulder off. And that's the last time I ever shot that shotgun. I bought a single-action single shot bolt action 22, and I started shooting up the whole place in New Hampshire. We were in the woods for a while, and I started shooting. And then I killed a chipmunk, and I picked it up and looked at it, just a little chipmunk, and I saw what this bullet had done, what it had done. And I realized, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. This is crazy. You know, this is nuts. So I think, more recently now, I've gone back to my high school website where they have people who are training these kids in ROTC. And what they're training them is marching and carrying flags and with the bands. But what they're really training for is to be indoctrinated into the shoot 'em up society.
No, absolutely. And Frank, let me do this because I want to get the other calls, but I want to just pivot from what you were saying there, because it is this mentality. Like Frank was saying, well, maybe everybody should be trained on how to use a gun and this and that, Eric. But then,
shoot an animal so you get the meaning of death with a gun. Is
right.
that what he's saying?
But my point is, what I think he's trying to say here is that there is this shoot 'em up culture, this history that we have here, where we're indoctrinating people into the culture of violence, you know, that violence is okay. You see it everywhere. You see it in the video games that our kids play. You see it on the TV. You see it on cable shows. You see it in the movies. I mean, it's just, you know, everywhere. It's omnipresent, this culture of violence. But when he said we should train everybody how to handle a gun, that started me thinking, Eric, you know, that's the problem with society. Why train that? Why not train every kid on how to use a computer, Eric? Why not train a kid on how to use a Texas Instrument calculator? Why don't we train kids on how to do a differential equation in calculus? I mean, why should everyone be trained to kill, to seek, murder, kill, and destroy? Why can't we train people and children on heightening consciousness and awareness and education and using the tools of society to make things better, not to destroy things?
Right. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. So and that's what I was thinking about when I heard – you know, Mark, talk about that. You know, maybe we should train everybody for guns. I don't think so. Let me go next to Steve. Steve's listening in Chicago, Illinois, where there's a spate of ongoing violence and people being killed on a daily basis as a result of guns. So, Steve, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I want to make a couple of points. One, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, we have a culture of violence. But more importantly than simply the way in which the culture in terms of television, movies, video games, tends to depict the death of other people and shooting and the way it glorifies it. More so, I think that there's a cohort out there that believes and has been indoctrinated with this idea that society cannot protect you. Police forces cannot protect you. You need to become the Charles Bronsons and the Clint Eastwoods of the world because they grew up watching these sorts of television shows and movies where, you know, the good guy never accidentally misses and kills the innocent woman. You know, he always manages to nail the bad guy.
Right.
We live in a culture, I believe, where people honestly believe, you know, if I buy a gun and it's strapped to me and in the event of an emergency, I'm going to be just like Clint Eastwood. I'm going to take out the
right
bad guys. I'm not going to hit anybody else.
No collateral damage, and it's very sanitized. Listen, I appreciate your comments there, Steve. We've got to go to a break. We're going to be back with your calls. We still got Jack on the line, Seth, Robert, Paul, Al, Ted, others. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Give us a call on the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike sitting in. We're going to get to all the Freedom Lines, if not this segment, sometime in the next hour. So if you have something to say, definitely stay tuned. But we do have our special correspondent, Victoria Jones, with Talk Radio News today. So, Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you back again.
Thank you. Well, it's quite lively in Washington this week. What was supposed to be a recess week for the House of Representatives isn't, because the GOP-led House is bound and determined to defund Obamacare or bust.
Wow.
Doing it, as a matter of fact. And,
well, I liked how you said recess, Victoria, because it makes me think of kindergartens when you refer to the GOP in the House.
Well, there's a fair amount of that going on, actually, today. In fact, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said, gave a blistering opening speech on the Senate floor today, including the line, "We're not going to bow to Tea Party anarchists who refuse to accept that the Supreme Court ruled that Obamacare is constitutional." And then it was interesting. Then he moved to proceed to the House passed spending bill, which defunds Obamacare, and it also funds the government at the sequester levels, that's the cuts, through the 15th of September. And then after he'd done that, he tried to move to the consideration of some nominees, people who've been nominated for jobs. And Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, the Republican who's opposed to all this, objected without offering any explanation for why he was objecting. So this led to a bit of a delay, and then you could see Cruz and Reid on the floor talking to each other. And then suddenly, inexplicably, Cruz changes his mind, doesn't object anymore, and they proceed to the consideration of these nominees. Nobody knows quite why all this happened. People think it might be that Cruz didn't understand what was going on and was objecting because he thought that Reid was moving to the Obamacare defunding bill.
Right.
Because he's so excited about it, he wasn't really listening.
Well, what are we hearing about this, though, Victoria, with respect to what's going to happen? Are we going to shut down, or are cooler heads going to prevail? I mean, what's your sense of what's happening?
My sense is that it's going to be a real squeaker, and I wouldn't even want to predict it at this point. I mean, Harry Reid has got control of it at the moment because now the bill's in the Senate. He can decide how, sort of, to some extent, he can decide how quickly it moves through. Some of it's decided by things like Rule 22. I think it's Rule 22, which determines how many hours have to be given up for debate after this happens and that happens. So some of it will just have to proceed at a certain pace. And so it's actually possible that this bill, if it gets stripped of Obamacare funding, won't make it back to the House anyway until the weekend.
Mm-hmm. And
well, that's getting pretty close.
Right, because it would be October 1st is the deadline, correct?
That's right.
Wow. Okay. Well, what else
is
happening?
Well, then the House has to decide what it's going to do with it.
Right.
We don't know.
All right. Well, what else we got happening?
Other things we've got going on. Iran's new foreign minister is going to meet counterparts from the five permanent Security Council members plus Germany on Thursday at the UN to discuss resuming talks on his country's nuclear program. The Iranian minister would in that case, meet Secretary of State John Kerry. And that would be one of the highest face-to-face contacts between Iran and the U.S. in more than three decades.
Well, that's progress.
Potentially. Meanwhile, however, at least 64 lawmakers from both parties are joining forces on a campaign demanding the release of an imprisoned Iranian-American who was arrested in 2011 on charges of being a CIA spy. He, of course, is one of nearly 1,000 people who are imprisoned in Iran for absolutely no reason whatsoever other than what they believe or who they are.
Wow. Unfortunate there.
Very. Very. Also, lawmakers want a probe, Democratic lawmakers, but I imagine they'll get Republicans to come in on with them on this. But at the moment, it's Representative Henry Waxman and Anna Eshoo sent a letter today to the heads of the FCC and the Commerce Department, National Telecommunications and Information Administration, telling them they want them to investigate reports that first responder radios failed during last week's shooting at Washington's Navy Yard, and they want them to work with other federal and local officials to investigate the problems.
Yeah, well, that would make sense if something like that failed. That would be another tragedy within a tragedy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it did. I mean, it was reported that numerous firefighters and police officers couldn't communicate using their radios when they responded. I mean, some equipment stopped working as officers went into the building, and at least one officer had to rely on his cell phone.
Oh, my lordy. My lordy. What else we got, Victoria?
And that's a pretty crazy thing. Another thing is that the military today effectively pronounced the end of the mass hunger strike among detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which has been a six-month protest. At one point, a majority of the inmates were striking, but it refocused global attention on the prison, and it pretty much pushed the Obama administration to revive the effort to shutter it. The military is not going to issue daily updates on the number of inmates participating in the protest or anything like that anymore. But one of the lawyers for several detainees said that the strike ended because the men achieved their objectives. He said, as far as I know, Qurans are not being searched. Guantanamo's returned to the national agenda, and President Obama has renewed efforts to close it. Now, the military spokesman is saying that the policy and practice of searching Qurans has not changed.
Hmm. Did anybody die from that hunger strike that we know of?
No.
Okay, so everybody made it through. All right, well, listen, Victoria, we're coming up on a break, so we really appreciate your time with Talk Radio News, and thank you so much for those pearls of information and wisdom.
Thank you so much.
Okay, that's Victoria Jones. Listen, when we come back at the top of the next hour, definitely stay tuned. I'm going to get to the Freedom Lines, definitely get to your calls, but we also have a very interesting guest coming on. He's an author and screenwriter and talks about the jurisprudence system or the lack thereof, being accused of a felony when you've done absolutely nothing, and then getting justice by none other than Judge Judy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. And you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. We have another special guest on the line. As many of you know, Tom is a very prolific author, and I always have a soft spot in my heart for authors and people telling us their personal stories. So today we have an author and screenwriter. His name is Steve Bevilacqua, and his latest book, Kafka at the Beach, a layman's handbook for those falsely accused of felonies. And Steve wrote a piece in the Huffington Post in July 2013 entitled Lights, Camera, Justice. If only the Los Angeles court system were more like justice. Judy. So with that being said, Steve, welcome to the table.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's great to have you here. Well, Steve, before we get into the gist of what happened to you, because, you know, it's look, we've all been accused of things in life. I mean, I've been accused of this or that, maybe in the household or telling a little white lie. But getting accused of a felony, that sounds pretty serious.
Oh, yeah. This was a doozy. It was huge, actually.
Yeah.
Especially because the thing that I was falsely accused of, it was a list of charges, but the one came with a mandatory 18-month prison sentence. So it's not like getting blamed for something around the house. Yeah, it was like way bigger than that.
Right. What do you mean I didn't clean the dishes? You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
So now you're off to the slammer for a year and a half. Yeah. But, well, here's what happened. Basically, I live out here in Venice Beach, and one morning, it was a Sunday morning, stepped out of my apartment to go get some coffee down on the corner. And I was crossing the street at the crosswalk when this road rage maniac driver just saw me. She, you know, basically ran me down. I jumped out of the way because I saw her coming. And she knocked me on my butt. And as I yelled to her, like, yo, she stuck her fist out the window, gave me the finger, and kept driving.
Oh, nice. So a hit and run.
Yeah, pretty much hit and run. And then she fled the scene. All of this she admitted later, but we'll get there. The crazy thing is, because she was pretty crazy, she just drove about 100 feet up the street and started parking. So she was really out of her mind. It's a long story. But basically, so I walked up to her and said, you just ran me down, at which point she was so enraged, she actually attacked me. And started screaming obscenities, and then followed me through the streets of Venice Beach for a good hour and a half because I had the maniac road rage woman following me. So, long story short, by the time the police and the city attorneys were done processing this whole incident, the woman who admitted running me down and admitted fleeing the scene, admitted giving me the finger, admitting all these things, got charged with nothing. But based on an offhanded comment she made after the fact that I made a grab for her bag, which was pretty laughable since I'd just been hit by a car, I got charged with a whole lot of things and almost went to prison for a year and a half for basically getting hit by a car. I was in court fighting for my freedom for, almost a year. And it was absurd. It was something right out of Kafka. It was really shocking to find out, like, firsthand how our criminal justice system works.
Or doesn't work.
Huh? What's that?
Or doesn't work.
It doesn't work. I mean, basically, it was really shocking. I mean, the decisions are not based on any kind of, well, certainly not on the facts and certainly not on any sense of justice. It was pretty shocking to find out how things really operate once you're in the clutches of our court system.
Now, how long, Steve, did this take you? So from the time that you actually were you're hit by this woman, it's a hit and run. Then you kind of stumble upon her later and say, hey, you know, you're the woman who hit me. It almost sounds like a Larry David episode there for a second there.
It does, actually. That part of it certainly does, yes.
Yeah. But then you get embroiled in this jurisprudence system. So what were they saying? Why were they giving you, the guy who was hit by a car, all this grief? What do you think was at play here? Was it egos?
Well,
was it racism? I mean, what was it?
It might have been. You know what? There's certain things that even today, having like examined this thoroughly, we still cannot answer. But I do know this. They did misspell my name. My last name is Bevilacqua. But if you misspell it the way the police did that day, and it ends with an E, it does look pretty Hispanic. I'm pretty sure they assumed I was Latino, because one of the things I was charged with was this anti-gang statute passed under some Prop 22, I think it was, which is ridiculous, because I've never been in a gang in my life. It was weird that they just tacked that one on. By the way, that was the one that came with the 18-month mandatory prison sentence.
Wow.
That was the most unshakable thing. But once we were in court, but which was ridiculous because, you know, when something comes with a mandatory prison sentence, there's no plea bargaining. you say yes, you're on the bus to prison. You know, you don't get, even the judge can stop.
So now, Steve, what do you do now? Here you are, just a guy minding your own business. You know, you're a screenwriter. Tell people to you. You're also a screenwriter. You write screenwriting for the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yes, actually, well, I did a lot of that while paying the bills while writing this book over the years it took. I write a lot of low budget horror and sci-fi movies. Yeah.
Right. So here
you know, giant crocodile kind of thing.
right. Well, you could have never imagined such horror with respect to this.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the weird thing is, I mean, once they have you in their clutches, man, it is insane. I mean, they were just bullying me and postponing things, for weeks. I mean, I was in court over this for about 8 months.
Wow.
And they just kept stalling and badgering me and trying. I mean, basically, when you're in court, they call your name, you go step before the judge, and then what happens is, in an odd way that I didn't realize, then most of the actual business of the deal goes on in the hallway. You go out into the hallway and you block traffic and you try to reason with the prosecutor.
Right.
And then, you know, and then they just kept stalling and trying to badger me into pleading guilty. And it was costing me a lot of money. It cost me like tens of thousands of dollars.
That's insane.
Out all this time.
So here you are, you get hit and run, and now you're in this legal battle costing you tens of thousands of dollars, accused of a felony. It's very surreal, to say the least.
It is surreal. That's why, I mean, the book is called Kafka at the Beach, and it really did, from the get-go, really take on a very Kafka-esque quality. It was very surreal. I was standing in the hallway of a courthouse here, one morning, and had a prosecutor, or a city attorney, tell me, like, literally, how can you claim that you don't, you know, you admit you don't understand the law, but you can claim to be innocent. How can you claim to be innocent if you don't know the law? I was like, you know, because I haven't done anything, man. You know, this is ridiculous. I was crossing the street. But moments like that were straight out of, like, Franz Kafka. And so, but
unbelievable.
The more I saw just how the court system is run, and it really is, basically, the city attorneys don't care about anything other than their own performance record. They go for slam dunk easy convictions. They go after minorities. They go after poor people. And it is the sad truth of the matter. Because you know what? There's no doubt in my mind that if I were a minority, I'm a white guy. But if I weren't, or if I didn't have the money to, like, you know, fight this off, I'd be in prison right now for something I didn't do, for something that never actually even happened.
No.
This is how it goes, man. They don't care about what really happened. You know.
Yeah. And then the other thing, too.
Moments where, along the way, when I really was running out of resources, I was running out of money to pay the lawyer. There was a certain point where it was like, I don't have any more money to pay you. And it looked like I was going to end up in prison for this because
wow.
I couldn't fight it anymore. And they can fight you forever until that's the point of the book. There are very certain things I learned the hard way that would help anyone else who finds themselves in this situation. For instance, you have a constitutional right to assert your right to a trial. Which, after months and months and months of them badgering and bullying me, I finally did. I went before the judge and said, I'm asserting my right to a trial. And at that point, once you say those magical words, they have to start a trial. Or they have to let it go.
And they have a certain time frame to do that, right?
0 to 10. Yeah.
0 to 10 days.
0 to 10 days. Yep. But, you know, they start to 0 to 10 days. Then they can kind of interrupt it. I had about 3 or 4, can't remember, 0 to 10 days. And then at a day, like at day 6 or so, they'll come up with some stall tactic. But once you really put your foot down and go before the judge and do that petition of saying, this is it, I'm asserting my right,
right. You
really do have 10 days to start it.
All right, Steve, do me a favor. Hold on a second, because I want to get to the dramatic conclusion, because somehow or another, Judge Judy gets involved to mete out justice, and I think that is the most ironic twist of it all. So when we get back, we'll conclude with your story, okay? So can you hold on for a few more minutes?
All right.
All right, we'll be right back with Steve Bevilacqua. He's author and screenwriter of Kafka at the Beach, a layman's handbook for those falsely accused of felonies.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today. We have a special guest on the line. His name is Steve Bevilacqua. We often hear about these travesties of justice. And look, we've seen, you know, the O.J. Simpson case. We've seen Casey Anthony, George Zimmerman, people accused of felonies who for the most part, many of us felt were definitely guilty. But here we have sort of an opposite case. We have a case where Steve was walking across the street one day, minding his own business, gets hit by a car, involved in a hit and run, and then ultimately he's the one accused of a felony and then gets caught in this net of craziness in our jurisprudence system. So Steve is back here to tell us the dramatic conclusion of this crazy, crazy story. The book is called Kafka at the Beach, a layman's handbook for those falsely accused of felony. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
Good.
Okay, so where we left off, I was about to go to prison for 18 months for something that never happened. But after successfully fighting that off by forcing them to take it to trial, what happened was they went to trial for 2 days and then threw their hands in the air and did this big blustery, we don't have time for this thing. So it did get kind of dismissed finally after 8 months and tens of thousands of dollars. Now what happened next was, and this is where it gets really interesting, I then decided to sue the driver for making deliberately false statements to the police that cost me a lot of money and even more time. And then I couldn't really get it. No civil attorney would take my case, even though they all admitted I would win, hands down. I'd never collect, so they weren't going to do it because, you know, all they cared about was money. So my clever scheme after that was to break this down into increments of $5,000 and take it to handle it myself in small claims court, which is what I was doing when the Judge Judy show called me because they found me on the court docket. And what happened after that was pretty amazing, actually, because everything that our real actual court system spent 8 months just getting completely wrong and in this the most surreal, absurd ways, Judge Judy, with a TV show, set everything right in one afternoon. It was amazing. You'd think that the TV court would just be doing, you know, go after the most sensational, outrageous kind of, like, you know, things to get ratings. And actually, she was more serious about it than the actual attorneys. You know,
wow.
Like, perfect example. We were about 7 months into this in court, standing in the hallway one day, when my lawyer and I realized, and it was pretty astounding, it was pretty shocking, that the city attorney we were talking to, who was then in charge of the case, had actually not read the police report. Like, he was faking it. And he got caught in a bunch of lies. And we were just standing there going, you know, he hadn't read it. In fact, and then his attitude was that it was almost beneath him to have to read something like this. So whereas Judge Judy, you go in there, you're standing on that set that looks like a court but is a set, and the first thing she did was just insist on all paperwork being brought to her. Paperwork which then she referred to as voluminous because it was a pretty big pile. And then she made us all stand there sweating bullets while she read every page of it. And we just stood there for a long time while she just, like, methodically read the whole thing. Then she got to the end. Then she shoved it aside. And then the fireworks started like you've never seen. It was,
uh-oh.
That was loud and terrifying. What happened after that? Nonetheless, I think she is amazing, and she really could teach. That was the whole Huffington Post, piece. It was sort of like what Judge Judy could teach the Supreme Court or the George Zimmerman, you know, courtroom, which, you know, everything is just this meat grinder of technicalities. And, you know, you try stuff like that to Judge Judy, and she tears you a new one on TV, you know, and she really is very down to earth and very much concerned with the actual facts of the case and justice and setting things right.
Wow. And so what did she ultimately end up concluding?
Basically, it was interesting because she actually came out screaming at me. And you know what? Fine. I deserved it. I was pretty dumb to even fall into the situation. But the real crux of the matter was she was going to see. I mean, the only thing that gave any validity to this, the driver's story, was that I was so enraged when she hit me with her car that I attacked her and tried to rob her bag. So Judge Judy just screamed at me for a good, seemed like years, to see how belligerent I got when attacked. But it didn't happen. I mean, I was just apologizing and just, like, you know, just melting there on her set. And then when she was done with that, and then kind of the big test was over, she turned around and just ripped the driver's head off for a long time. It was beautiful, actually. And so then she ruled in my favor, and she gave me as much as she could. There's actually pretty strict limits on how much Judge Judy can award you, and it wasn't nearly close to what it the incident cost me. But
right.
She gave me what she could and apologized for not being able to give me the rest. And I thanked her profusely and then and moved on with my life a lot wiser.
Wow. Now, in the interim, have you been accused of any other felonies, or you've been pretty good?
No. You know, but there are things you learn, you know, that I learned the hard way that are pretty much laid out in the book, things to avoid falling into what I fell into.
Sure.
In terms of, like, how to deal with the cops. When the cops say, oh, you can trust me, you don't necessarily want to believe that.
Right.
Want to be pretty cautious about, yeah, what you say. Of course, with me and the police, and I did this in front of witnesses, which was cool. I actually specifically asked the police, do I need to make a statement? And they said, no, it's okay, we'll take care of it. And there were people who heard them say that. So when they, like, wrote this police report that was just insane, we could, you know, refute it.
Right. Which was never read by the prosecutor.
What's that?
Which was never read by the prosecutor.
Well, exactly, which we were a good 7 months into the court process before that even came up because no one read the police report. Yeah. So anyway, but all in all, it is amazing that the TV court, where you least expect it, was actually more concerned with setting things right in a justice kind of way than our actual court system. Which
Performance record. We're coming up on the end here. So, Eric, you have a question?
Yeah, it's Eric here. I have a question. Did you actually collect your money?
I did. Oh, best thing about Judge Judy, if you win in a real court, you got to go through the whole collection process, and you might not ever get paid. If
nice.
You win on Judge Judy, the TV show writes you a check for your settlement, pretty much on the spot.
Wow. So there it is.
Yeah,
it's a happy ending.
I didn't want to do this on TV. I was terrified of going on TV.
No doubt. Well, listen, Steve, we're up against the break here, so it's called Kafka at the Beach, a layman's handbook for those falsely accused of felonies, and I'm sure people can Google it or check it out and get it online, right?
Facebook page, Kafka at the Beach, on Amazon, and thank you, Mike, for having me on. I really appreciate it, man.
All right. Stay out of trouble.
I will.
All right. Take care. All right. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be back with more in a moment and your calls on the Freedom Lines.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX here in Phoenix, Arizona, this is Dr. Mike sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back. Tom Hartman Program, Dr. Mike sitting in today. Eric, that's got to be scary, though, to be accused of a felony and then have to spend the next, like, 8 months just fighting for your innocence and then to be out, like, tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, that's not right.
I mean, I think in England, if I'm not mistaken, or somewhere out there, they have the system where a loser pays. So if you accuse somebody of something and then it turns out that the accused
was wrong,
exonerates themselves or was not.
Whoever loses pays.
Right. Whoever loses pays.
That's fair.
What do you think about that?
I think that's pretty fair. And it kind of works like that in family court sometimes. Like, you know, like if my ex-wife were to accuse me of taking drugs or something and I passed the drug test, she'd have to pay for all that.
Right, right. So it's interesting if something like that could be set up
not
here
that that's ever
in America.
Happened.
Unless you always have Judge Judy as a fallback if you could win in that particular venue. But that was kind of interesting, though, because you get your whole settlement paid right there on the spot.
Yeah, it's not like the real thing.
Right?
where even if you get awarded a judgment, you'll never see the money.
I'm taking all my future disputes to Judge Judy.
Yeah, hopefully she sees you on the court docket.
Yes, exactly.
I didn't know that's how that worked either.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I necessarily want to be on the court docket either. So that doesn't sound...
Yeah, I try to avoid that.
That doesn't sound fun either. But in any case, listen, so we have no more guests for the rest of the program, so we're going to go bareback here. The Freedom Express is going to continue to chug along, so we're going to open up the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Anything that you guys want to talk about, the good doctor is here for you. So let's get right back to the lines. Let's go first to Jack on the line. He's listening on Free Speech TV. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Newcomb. Well, hello, Dr. Newcomb, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd appreciate your thoughts. Our multinational, pharmaceutically-based world health care system, initially envisioned and funded by a handful of wealthy banker industrialists, with consequences not only of driving out the competition, as we saw in the way they funded and established the AMA, who made and continue to keep alternative medical practices largely illegal, but due to the profit motive of these massive multinational pharmaceuticals, whose marketplace capital mandate for unregulated profit relies on an increasingly less healthy world, replete with new diseases, continuous supplies of symptom-based chemical treatments that trick, destroy, and disable the body's own very brilliant native defenses, and its ability and wisdom to heal itself in most cases without these deadly, riddled with side effect, yet very profitable drug interventions. Now, considering what is being invested by the billionaires who own these pharmaceuticals and their medical counterparts in organizing the throwback right-wing congressional single-payer healthcare revolting revolt, what is it in the single-payer system that threatens their empire? And do you think it could be the probability we could get healthier because of it?
Well, look, you know, I was always an advocate during the whole healthcare debate of a single-payer kind of a system because, look, here's the bottom line. Is if you look at the for-profit motive, when it comes to healthcare in particular, it's very easy if you look at it in a very fundamental way, Jack, and I've explained this on the air, but I'll do it very quickly here, is that if, say, there's a million people, okay, and we are all beneficiaries and we all put in whatever, you know, $10,000 to have our health care insurance for, you know, a year. Well, that money goes into the pot of the insurance company, okay? Now, the insurance company says, wow, we have, you know, a million people, and you multiply that by 10,000, and, you know, we got 100 million or whatever the math is, you know, in a big bucket right now. Now, what they're going to say, especially these companies that are publicly traded, the more that we can keep into that big bucket, guess what? We're going to be, you know, richer, our shareholders are going to be richer, and everyone's going to be happy, except the beneficiaries who have the health insurance. So what they need to do are two things. Every time somebody gets sick or every time somebody has access to the healthcare system to see a doctor, to see a specialist, to get a wellness exam, little by little, that money goes out of the bucket. And the more and more that goes out of the bucket, the less, quote unquote, profitable the for-profit is. So at the end of the day, what they do is they take a lot of that money that's in the bucket that goes to the CEO, the CFO, you know, it, maybe to a certain extent to shareholders. So now rather than saying, think of it as a gallon of milk, rather than starting out with a gallon of milk, now you only got maybe three quarters of a gallon of milk left to basically, if you will, use that to feed the healthcare system, to take care of all these other people. And then at the end of the day, what they try to do, the for-profit system, is to create barriers so that less and less of that milk goes out so that at the end of the year, the more milk that's in there, the more profit they have. And then the other side of that is at the end of the year, if they don't have enough milk left in the carton, they just up the premiums, Jack. They act to get more milk back in. They extort it from the consumer, and then they start fresh again, and the whole game's played over and over again. So I understand what you're saying in the for-profit-driven healthcare system. And if you look at Medicare, Medicare is not a for-profit system. If you look at Medicare, the way that it's set up, Medicare doesn't skim a lot of money off the top like these private for-profit health insurance companies do. That money, like I said, goes immediately, a big chunk of it, 10, 15, 20%. Or more at times to the CEOs, the management, the CFO, the chief financial officer, the operational officer. They skim that off at the top, and then you have a lot less left to deal with delivering health care to the patient. So that's why Medicare, if you really look at it, it only costs like 5%, like, you know, 5 cents on every dollar is going to administer the health care. So you often hear about the red tape, the bureaucratic red tape of Medicare and government-run health care. It's quite the opposite, actually. Medicare runs much more efficiently from an administrative perspective than does a private for-profit health company. So I agree with you in principle there that a single-payer healthcare system, you know, would be a lot more efficient. You know, and that was offered. A lot of people said, look, leverage the Medicare system that we have, let people buy into the Medicare system, and let it compete against the private companies. But again, a lot of the conservative legislators didn't want to see private health insurance companies compete head-to-head with a Medicare, which is basically a single-payer healthcare. So listen, Jack, I appreciate your comments. I'm going to get back to some of the other Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. Let's go next to Seth. He's listening online in Blacksburg, Virginia, and wants to talk about sort of the spiritual nature of our country and our children in particular. So, Seth, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, thank you. How are you?
Every day's a blessing there, Seth.
This is on gun control, actually.
Ah, okay.
My observation is that in places of worship and in family education, there's not enough education on chakra development and connection with the earth. and love of self, family, friends, community, and God.
Right.
And those are issues that, in some cases, obviously there is, but in many cases there is not. And this is, I think, contributing towards the increase in gun violence.
What do you think we could do, Seth, to actually change that, though? What would you recommend at a national or local level so that children, as they're young and growing up, they are exposed to this kind of philosophy?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I was raised in this context, and I can't imagine committing gun violence. You know, I'm drawing a blank because, you know, I mean, I feel like you just do that. I think that for, let's take an African-American perspective, for example. I think that Christianity is a kind of colonialism in African-American neighborhoods. It's foreign in a way, and I think that it would be a great advantage for African-Americans in the inner cities to invite, let's say, West African shamans to come help with understanding, getting back to connection with the earth.
With the no, I understand. So let me do this, Seth, because I want to get to the other calls too. But so what you're talking about is a more holistic spiritual approach where we get more connected to sort of Mother Earth and the natural elements in our world versus, you know, sort of the fabricated, made up, pro-violence culture that we see here in this country, and I definitely agree with that. So let me get back to the Freedom Lines because I want to try to get as many people in as possible today. Many of you have been holding for quite some time here. So let me go next to Tina. Tina is listening from Travelers Rest, South Carolina. And Tina, welcome.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind today, Tina?
I just heard that piece you just did on TV with Steve Bevilacqua.
Yes.
Yeah, he was falsely accused of a felony.
Correct.
He's Italian. I'm Italian, too. And I was falsely accused, not of a felony, but my husband falsely accused me of being suicidal and of threatening to kill him.
Uh-huh.
He went to the police and the court down here and told them that I was suicidal and homicidal. And he petitioned the court to have me committed, and they did. They committed me for 25 days. They drugged me unnecessarily against my will.
Wow.
And I can't get, and I am on disability for depression, Mike. And as a disabled person, I'm supposed to have rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but
sure.
No one's honoring it down here.
Well, maybe what you might want to do is do what Steve Bevilacqua did and sue your husband, get on that court docket, and hopefully Judge Judy could pick it up, and then maybe you'll get justice. But that's very sad to hear that you were falsely accused of such a thing and then had to be involuntarily committed and not necessarily get the kind of care that you need. So my heart goes out to you, Tina, and thank you for sharing that story with us here live on the Tom Hartman Program. The Freedom Express pulling up to its final stop, its final destination for the day. So we got lots of other people in the queue. Stick with us. We'll be back, 1-866-987-THOM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX here in Phoenix, Arizona, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, I want to know your take. So if you have a comment or question for our radio or TV show, grab your phone or turn on your computer, point the camera at your own face, hit record, and send your videos to yourtakemytake@gmail.com. Don't want to be seen on TV? Then leave a voice message on our rant line at 202-536-5306 and tune into The Big Picture every Thursday night for our Your Take, My Take live segment.
Okay, welcome back. Let's get right to the Freedom Lines here. We have a short segment ahead of us. I want to try to get as many people in as possible. So let's first go, let's see here, Eric. Let's go to Tom. Tom in Miranda, California has got a very interesting idea. Tom, welcome to the program.
Yeah, my idea is that Congress can only pass, they passed gun legislation, but it's been to authorize guns on trains and on parks, So my idea is to get the Congress to authorize carrying guns in the in the congressional floor and in the balcony.
Why should they have?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Tom. Finish up.
Why should they have work in a gun-free zone when the rest of us can't, since they're so adamantly pro-gun? And they also say the only way to protect yourselves from guns, a bad guy with a gun, is to have good guys with the guns.
Hey,
so
Tom,
that's really true.
Well, first of all, I love your idea. I think it's genius. I would love to see a congressman or a congresswoman put that up for actual vote. I mean, we have Congresswoman Sinema here in Arizona who I think if we can contact her, she might very well have the gumption to put such a bill out there, because understanding full well ahead of time that, you know, they would never authorize something like that. I would think they wouldn't, but who knows? Maybe they're that crazy. Eric, what do you think? Are they?
I don't know. That's pretty scary, Mike.
I think
when it comes to their own safety, there's no way it's going to happen.
Yeah, because what Tom is saying right on the floor, so any of the congressmen or women in the House of Representatives or the Senate, for that matter, they can all be packing heat, and then all the people who come in, you know, you'll get frisked and all, but as long as you have a valid permit and all, you could be up there in the balcony and, you know, just packing heat as well. Tom, I think it's a great idea. I'm going to try to follow up with some of the people I know in Congress and see if it takes root, okay?
Okay, I like to hear the arguments against it. I like to hear them stand up, the Republicans stand up and say, oh, no, this couldn't happen, you know. And
right. What's good for the goose is good for the gander, right?
The gander. That's right.
Exactly. Hey,
Texas Republican Louis Gohmert says he's drafting such a bill.
Is he?
Yes.
I'd love to see that, because then you would see the true hypocrisy of these conservative legislators when it comes to their own safety and –
there's no way they're going to let guns down on the congressional floor. But, you know, this guy's trying to make it so that you can carry a gun anywhere in D.C. and including on the congressional floor.
Yeah, well, be interesting.
Louis Gohmert from Texas, of course.
Will be interesting to see, you know, what they have to say regarding that. Okay, let's go next to Lee. Lee is in Berwyn, Illinois. Lee wants to talk a little bit about Medicare. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program, Lee.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well.
Hello?
Yes, yeah, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about Medicare. That's Tom actually is pretty familiar with my situation. I grew up in a town in Montana. Anyway, I'm 51 and I'm on Medicare. I've been on it for a year because I've been diagnosed with the asbestos-related disease. Anyway, it's a long story, but I just wanted to say I've been on it for a year and I'm self-employed and it's extremely affordable. Compared to what I was paying out of pocket myself. So I'm real happy with Medicare. I actually talked to the billing department, my doctor, when I was going through this, because there's like all this stuff that you have access to with Advantage plans, all this stuff. And their advice was just stick with Medicare A and B, for my age. And that's been extremely, it's worked really well.
Good. Well, you're a happy customer then.
I'm totally happy. It's like, and, you know, it really, to me, it's like I understand why this could be a great single payer, you know, it could be great for everybody, not just people that are 65. You know, this could be a really great insurance program.
It might not be too far in the future. I know there's a lot of people working on the ground to push for something along those lines, so only time will tell. So, Lee, thank you so much. I'm going to get to some of the other callers right now. Let's go next to Eric, who's listening on Free Speech TV from Middletown, New York. Eric, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, that's Mike. Good to talk to you. I got to say, it's amazing to hear Mr. Ben Blackford's story because I experienced something nearly identical myself. I'm actually currently in year six of litigating it. But the many ways he characterized the system, the individuals in it, the kind of paternalistic arrogance they treat you with if you presume to know anything about your own case as an individual defendant, and the way they'll, you know, intentionally try to put stumbling blocks to keep you from getting anywhere, like all he went through to get to trial. I just would love to have a conversation with that man. There's a few people that you can share a story like that with and have them not look at you like you're crazy. And
well, you know what, Eric? It sounds like from what you're saying and what Steve says, this might be an all too common occurrence with respect to people being falsely accused of felonies and not having necessarily the expertise or the financial wherewithal to adequately defend yourself. And like Steve was saying earlier, that if it was somebody who maybe doesn't know the law, Steve's a very bright guy. I mean, he's a graduate from the University of Pennsylvania, and he knows his stuff. So he was able maybe to weather the storm somewhat. But people who are maybe not in that similar type of situation don't have the same resources or the same, you know, sort of intellectual capital to go up against these bullies, will capitulate and ultimately just say, hey, I'm guilty and I don't have any more money, and just I'll do the time. And that, if that's what's happening in America, Eric, that is a very sad testament to what our jurisprudence system has become. When people like O.J. Simpson and Casey Anthony and George Zimmerman can get off, and people like yourself and Steve have to lose their life savings for frivolous lawsuits, there's something wrong with the system. So thank you so much, Eric, for calling in, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, listen, I apologize to those of you who I could not get to, but as always, we want to thank, you know, the whole Tom Hartman program, the team. We want to thank, you know, Shane and Jim and Sean, and of course Tom and everybody else who participates in making this the number one progressive talk radio program, not only in the country, Eric, in the world.
Woo-hoo.
In the world. So as always, as Tom says, democracy is a participatory sport. So guess what? Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.